I wonder if you've ever looked at events in your life and wondered, what is God doing? Perhaps something has happened in your life that it seems that it would be easy for God to help, easy for God to take that trial away, and yet he doesn't seem to be doing anything. What is God doing? Or maybe you look at the state of our nation, some of the things happening in the world, people going away from worshipping God, churches failing to preach the truth, and you think, why doesn't God just send revival? Why doesn't he just change these things? What is God doing? Perhaps you're not a Christian and you think, well, this is why I don't believe in God. If there was a God, he'd be doing way more in the world. We'd know about it. We'd see the things he was doing. But it seems like God is doing nothing. What the Bible teaches is that while God does sometimes work miraculously and has done in the past, he usually works in the ordinary things of everyday life. He works with what we might call a hidden hand. It might not always be obvious to see what he's doing in the world, but he is always at work. And when you begin to see the world through the Bible's lenses, you begin to see God's hand working for good in everything. And that's what we see in this passage. David is God's king. He's in a very difficult situation, as we'll think about. It looks like all that happens in this passage is just a sequence of random events. But behind it all, we see God's hidden hand at work for the good of his people. Let's see what God's doing in this passage and see if it doesn't help us in our lives as well. We're going to see three things God's hidden hand is doing in this passage. And the first thing we see is God's hidden hand in the frustration of evil. We get that from verse 14, midway through. It says, "For the Lord had determined to frustrate the good advice of Ahithophel in order to bring disaster on Absalom." Absalom was plotting evil. So God frustrated his plans and he brought disaster on Absalom. Now, if you're here for the first time, you might be thinking, well, what's God got against this guy Absalom? Why is he causing disaster to come upon him? Well, he's taken over his father's kingdom. He's manipulated his way to the throne. Recently, in the passage before this one, he slept with various women on the rooftop to prove that he was a strong man. He is a terrible, wicked man that everyone should be wanting to be pulled down. And God's going to bring him his comeuppance. But he doesn't do this by a lightning bolt to shoot him from heaven. He's going to do it by frustrating the good advice of this man, Ahithophel. I want you to imagine Absalom's on his throne, whether he had a throne or not. Just imagine it for now. And there's two advisors. And the first advisor is this man, Ahithophel. And we're told at the end of our last chapter that his advice was like one who inquires of God. Now, that doesn't mean his advice is godly. In fact, he's just advised Absalom to do something horrifically bad. What it means is that Ahithophel seems to always, his plans always seem to succeed. Everything seems to work out for the best. And so both David and now Absalom trusted Ahithophel. Whatever he said, they knew was going to win them victory. And here's his advice now. Verses 1 to 3 of chapter 17. Ahithophel said to Absalom, "I would choose 12,000 men and set out tonight in pursuit of David. I would attack him while he is weary and weak. I'd strike him with terror, and then all the people with him will flee. I would strike down only the king and bring all the people back to you. The death of the man you seek will mean the return of all. All the people will be unharmed." So Ahithophel's plan is to attack David now. He's not ready for an attack. He's tired, he's weak. It'll be harder to defeat him when he's in a city behind walls. His men are well fed and ready. Now is the time to strike, Ahithophel says. So he plans to take this kind of crack troop of the 12,000 best men, go in there as quickly as possible, kill David, and then the journey's over, the war is over. Once David's gone, the army will surrender, Absalom will be king, it'll all be finished. But then there's this other advisor, a man called Hushai. Now, what you need to know about Hushai is he's actually a plant. He's an undercover agent for David. David told him to go to Jerusalem and pretend to support Absalom so that he could frustrate Ahithophel's advice. David knows Ahithophel's a military genius. He wants Hushai to do whatever he can to stop Ahithophel's plan from coming to fruition. So what does Hushai say? Well, you see that in verses 7 to 10. Hushai replying to Absalom, "The advice Ahithophel has given is not good this time. You know your father and his men. They are fighters and as fierce as a wild bear robbed of her cubs. Besides, your father is an experienced fighter. He will not spend the night with the troops. Even now he's hidden in a cave or some other place. If he should attack your troops first, whoever hears about it will say, 'There has been a slaughter among the troops who follow Absalom.' Then even the bravest soldier, whose heart is like the heart of a lion, will melt with fear. For all Israel know that your father is a fighter and that those with him are brave." Hushai says this, David and his men aren't wimps. There's a little bit of an implication there. By the way, Absalom, you there with your long L'Oreal hair, who's never been into battle one day in your life, you are a bit of a wimp. But there's this assumption, David is a fighter. He's fought many battles. His men are fighters. They could beat anyone. So what makes Ahithophel think he can just run in there and defeat these strong men? Plus, David wasn't born yesterday. He knows you're going to want to kill him, so he's probably hidden in a cave. Ahithophel wouldn't be able to go in there and win this battle easily. Finally, if they do lose this battle, then it's over for Absalom. It's all or nothing. People will hear that they've been defeated and they'll throw their weight behind David as the king. So he suggests another plan. Now, this is a worse plan, intentionally. But the reason it succeeds is because it strokes Absalom's ego. Verses 11 to 13. "So I advise you, let all Israel from Dan to Beersheba," that's sort of north to south, John O'Groats to Land's End if it was our country, "as numerous as the sand on the seashore, be gathered to you, with you yourself leading them into battle. Then we will attack him wherever he may be found, and we will fall on him as dew settles on the ground. Neither he nor any of his men will be left alive. If he withdraws into a city, then all Israel will bring ropes to the city and we will drag it down to the valley until not so much as a pebble is left." Sounds very stirring, doesn't it? Sounds like the kind of victory that would be spoken of through the ages. But the most important part of that speech is the phrase, "you yourself." Not Ahithophel, Absalom. You're going to win the victory. Everyone's going to come to you. Everyone will be speaking about you. You will be the conqueror. There's no indication that all of Israel are behind Absalom at this point. It's still very much 50-50 of that. But Absalom likes this idea. He likes this idea of victory. So he says in verse 14, "The advice of Hushai the Archite is better than that of Ahithophel." But the reason that happened, we're told, as I mentioned before, "for the Lord had determined to frustrate the good advice of Ahithophel in order to bring disaster on Absalom." What changed Absalom's mind? On one level, it was David sending Hushai to frustrate Ahithophel's plans. On another level, it was Hushai, whose quick wit had managed to win Absalom over to a wrong plan. On another level, it was Absalom's pride. He liked the idea of you yourself being the conqueror. But ultimately, God worked through all these things to frustrate this plan, which is going to work for evil. God is able to overcome the wicked using their own sin against them. I said this recently on an evening service, but I'll repeat it just for those of you that weren't there. It's a bit like in martial arts. Now, as you can probably tell, I'm not very good at any martial art, but apparently if you're involved in some martial art, judo or taekwondo or the like, you are trying to use your enemy's strength against them. So if they try to strike you, you might use that opportunity to flip them over onto the mats. That's what God does. He uses his enemy's strengths to become their weakness. His enemy's pride, he uses to work out his good purposes and frustrate their plans. And the ultimate time he did this was on the cross, wasn't it? Satan, the religious leaders Becky spoke of before, all of Jesus' enemies thought, this is the victory. We've got rid of him for now. And yet that victory ended up being the thing that won salvation for millions of people throughout the ages. God is able to overcome human pride and use it for the victory of his king. And that's a warning to us if we think we can go toe-to-toe with God. Don't make an enemy of God. He uses that pride to bring you down. But it's also an encouragement if you trust God. It might feel like you're up against it. It might feel like there's no hope. But come to God in prayer and he will work out his purposes. He will frustrate the seemingly strong plans of his enemies. Do you ever pray for God to frustrate the hands that are going against his will? Perhaps you pray on a national level, God, frustrate the plans of those who are working against your gospel in our country. You could pray for persecuted Christians around the world. Lord, frustrate the plans of those persecutors of your believing people. You could pray for individuals you know. God, my friend, he thinks that he can go on his own way without turning to you. Lord, frustrate his plans so that he'll come to an end of himself and realize the need for Jesus. God undermines those who go against him. And we can always pray for the hidden hand to be at work in frustrating people away from their sins. So that's the first one, God's hidden hand to frustrate the wicked. And secondly, we see God's hidden hand in the protection of his saints. Now, Hushai doesn't think the game is won yet. He knows that there's a danger. They might change plans. He needs to buy David some time. So what he does is he gets some messengers to go and give David a warning. And again, this is God's hand at work. He's protecting David, not through a miracle, not through the parting of the Red Sea or anything like that, but through the simple process of a message getting to David just in the nick of time. We see that in verses 15 to 16. Hushai told Zadok and Abiathar, the priests, Ahithophel has advised Absalom and the elders of Israel to do such and such, but I have advised them to do so and so. They're just summarizing. I don't want to repeat it all again. Now send a message at once and tell David, do not spend the night at the fords in the wilderness. Cross over without fail, or the king and all the people with him will be swallowed up. Why is it that they need to do this? Well, if you're on the wrong side of a river, you can be attacked. But if you crossed across the fords, it's a lot easier to defend that position. So David would be safe if he just gets across this river. It's going to buy him some valuable time. And so these messengers are sent out, but they run into a spot of bother. Verse 17, Jonathan and Ahimaaz were staying in at Enrogel. A female servant was to go and inform them, and they were to go and tell King David, for they could not risk being seen entering the city. But a young man saw them and told Absalom. So the two of them left at once and went to the house of a man in Bahurim. He had a well in his courtyard, and they climbed down into it. His wife took a covering and spread it out over the opening of the well and scattered corn over it. No one knew anything about it. It's getting tense here. You can imagine this in a movie. You can imagine the tension as the messengers are running away and the soldiers are chasing after them. They arrive in the courtyard. They've got to dive down into a well to stay safe. The woman puts a mat over the top and some grain in the hope that people won't notice that there's some men at the bottom of the well. You can imagine what it must be like for those two men at the bottom of the well. And maybe you can think back to when you were doing hide and seek as a kid and the person's right near you and every breath you take feels like it's being shouted through a megaphone. You're tense, you're worried, and these, of course, would have been worried for their lives. But what happens? When Absalom's men came to the women at the house, they asked, "Where are Ahimaaz and Jonathan?" The woman answered them, "They crossed over the brook." The men searched but found no one, so they returned to Jerusalem. What utter relief this must have been for those men. They are safe. But more importantly, that now means David can be safe. Verses 21 to 22. After they had gone, the two climbed out of the well and went to inform King David. They said to him, "Set out and cross the river at once. Ahithophel has advised such and such against you." So David and all the people with him set out and crossed the Jordan. By daybreak, no one was left who had not crossed the Jordan. David and his men are safe. The Jordan's not some tiny little brook. It's a big river. Only in these certain places would you be able to cross. If they're on the other side, they're safe. David has been saved. Now look, there's no miracles here, but God's hand is in it. In the simple acts, God has preserved his king. Through that message, through Absalom's men not spotting that there were two blokes hidden at the bottom of the well. Through the ingenuity of this woman, God's hand is at work. God promises to protect his people. Now, first and foremost, that means protecting his promises. He has promised to keep David on the throne, to make his kingdom last forever. Well, he's got to make sure that David lasts the night. God's enabled a way for him to be saved. But similar promises are made for the church. Jesus told his disciples that the gates of hell would not prevail against the church. He wasn't saying that the church would never be attacked, that God's people would never come under threat, but he's saying they would never win. Often it can seem like we're right up against it, maybe personally, in life, maybe as a church community, maybe as Christians across the nation or across the world. But God is able to protect his people. Sometimes you look back on your life and you see astonishing coincidences that seem to have protected you at just the right moment. Perhaps some of you have heard the story of Brother Andrew. He, during the communist period, used to smuggle Bibles into the Soviet states in Eastern Europe. Very dangerous to do. But there were countless occasions where he got up to the checkpoint, they opened up the car is rammed full of Bibles. They just don't notice what it is. Slam the door down, wave him through. God was protecting. Through the ignorance of the soldiers, God was protecting. And I'm sure you can think of times in your life where you could have fallen into a grave sin. Or you could have suffered in a severe way, but God just held you back. Perhaps you need to be praying for God's protection. Do you fear going into work for the first time as a young person that your faith might be tested? Well, pray for that protection. Do you see a young Christian that you know being tempted by their friends to go back to the way they once lived? Pray for protection. Do you have a temptation that seems impossible to overcome? Pray for protection. Indeed, that's what Jesus tells us to pray every day, isn't it? One of the lines in the Lord's Prayer is, "Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil." It's praying for God to help us in that daily battle we go through against sin and against suffering in the world. Now, that answer to prayer may not be spectacular. You might not even notice how God has answered that prayer for you. But God's hidden hand will be keeping you safe. And if you don't know Jesus yet for yourself, it's not that this protection is being kept off from you, but the offer is there for you to take it now. Life is full of pain and struggle. And trying to go there without Jesus is like running into battle without a weapon or anything to defend yourself with. Come unto Jesus and be protected from your own sin and all that life has to throw against you. It doesn't mean that you won't ever suffer, but it means that you will be able to get through to the end of the journey and eternal life forevermore. The final way we see God's hidden hand at work is in the provision of his servants. There's a slight difference between protection and provision. Protection is being shielded from harm. Provision is more the sort of positive end of it, God providing what you need. So if protection was praying, lead us not into temptation, provision is praying, give us today our daily bread. Give us the things that we need. Verses 24 to 26 basically just tell us about armies moving around. But the real important stuff happens in verses 27 to 29. When David came to Mahanaim, Shobi, son of Nahash, from Rabbah of the Ammonites, and Machir, son of Amiel, from Lodabar, and Barzillai, the Gileadite, from Rogelim, brought bedding and bowls and articles of pottery. They also brought wheat and barley, flour and roasted grain, beans and lentils, honey and curds, sheep and cheese from cow's milk for David and his people to eat. For they said, "The people have been exhausted, become exhausted and hungry and thirsty in the wilderness." Now, this might seem just a little by-the-way thing. oh, look, they had a nice fellowship lunch on the run. But now it's much more severe than that, much more important. If you look at military history, wars are won very rarely on the battlefield. They are won in the canteen. They're won in the supply chain. When armies have run out of food, that's when they start to get rebellious. That's when they start to get weak for the fight. And so a massive part of what armies do in war is to make sure that their troops are going to be fed, watered, have shoes on their feet, be kept warm. They're going to sleep. They're going to be ready for when the fight comes. So when David's men are described as exhausted and hungry and thirsty, it's not the kind of insignificant thing we describe with those words. You and I might say, I'm hungry because I've not eaten for an hour or something like that. Whereas this is probably days without food ever since they escaped. Or at least till we did find out last time that they got given food by one man, didn't we? But these men provide help. They give them what they need to overcome their struggles. Now, I imagine that those names rushed over your head as they did me. But those names are actually quite surprising people to help. One of them is an Ammonite. And I guess a number of you will know that the Ammonites were generally enemies of God's people. There's also this guy, Machir, who seems to have been a supporter of Saul, the man that David replaced on the throne. Generally, those guys were against David as well. So once again, we're surprised in this book about who's supporting David. David is rejected by his own people, but his enemies are supporting him. Yet even more, we see the provision of God through the provision of these men. It's an act of kindness by the men in question, no doubt about it. God has worked through them to make sure David and his men are rested, fed, and watered for the vital battle that is about to come upon them. God always works to provide his people just what they need at just the right time. It might not feel like that in the moment. It wouldn't have felt like it for those men as they marched through the wilderness, hungry, thirsty, without sleep. But God does provide what we need for each day. Sometimes it will be a subtle act of kindness from a brother or sister in Christ. And maybe giving money to someone in need. Maybe giving company to someone who's alone. This seems to happen particularly when people are doing some risky strategy for the kingdom. Have you read about the lives of missionaries out on the front lines? There's so many times where God miraculously provides what is needed just at the right time. Jesus told his disciples in the book of Luke, "Do not set your heart on what you will eat or drink. Do not worry about it. For the pagan world runs after such things. And your Father knows that you need them. But seek his kingdom, and these things will be given to you as well. Do not be afraid, little flock, for your Father has been pleased to give you the kingdom." When Jesus says that, he's not saying it in a harsh way, like, stop worrying, I'm sick to death of your moaning. That's not what he's saying. He's saying it to his little flock. He's saying, look, these things that you're worried about, don't worry. My Father's got those in hand. And you've got the most important thing. You've got the kingdom. This is what God is like to those who are his. He always provides what they need. Sometimes you're doing what you know is God's will, but it feels like I just can't go on. God provides his people what his people need. Seek his kingdom. Trust in him for the rest. And come to him in prayer. Well, as we wrap up, how do we apply this to ourselves in the week ahead? Firstly, there might be some Christians here going through a rough time. I mean, are there any of us who feel like we're not going through a rough time to some extent? Look out for God's hidden hand in these trials. Maybe he'll be working and frustrating sinners. Maybe he'll be frustrating your own sinful plans to stop you from doing things that would be wrong. And maybe he's stopping those attacks against you from others from being successful. Maybe he'll be working and protecting you. Life won't be easy, but there'll be a degree of protection from the worst things that could face you. Maybe he'll be at work in providing for you what you need in the moment, giving you not everything you want, but everything you need for the journey ahead. Learn to look for the hand of God. Learn to thank him, whatever the circumstances. And you'll begin to see more and more of the way that he's at work in your life. And if you're not a Christian this morning, if you don't know Jesus, perhaps it is that God is at work in that way, even just by the sense of you being here this morning. Perhaps you have plans to live your life without any reference to God, plans to ignore him from now onwards. But he's frustrated that plan by having you here this morning, sitting under the preaching of his word, reminding you that he is willing to welcome you back if only you turn to him. Perhaps God is protecting you. The Bible teaches that death is a terrible fate for those who don't know Jesus. But God offers you his son's death to protect you from the punishment of your sin. If you turn to Jesus for protection, then the worst things will be taken away from you. And perhaps God is providing for you, giving you one more opportunity this morning to turn from him, from your sin, and to eternal life. Don't resist the call of God. Come to him, because his side is always the side of victory, and those who fight against him always ultimately is the side of defeat.